that need writing. Sometimes this can be very useful. The problem is that if we get stuck in only that pattern, always looking for and picking up on the negative, even a paradise can become a hell. And worse, the better we get at scanning for the negative, the more we miss out on the positive, those things in life that bring us greater happiness, and in turn, fuel our success. The good news is that we can also train our brains to scan for the positive, for the possibilities dormant in every situation, and become experts at capitalizing on the happiness advantage. During a break from one of my talks in Australia, I walked outside to get some fresh air and stumbled upon two employees, also on a break. One glanced up at the sky and said, "It's nice that it's sunny today." The other one said, "I wish it wasn't so hot today." Both statements were based on reality. It was sunny, and it was hot. But the second person was giving into a habit that would prove debilitating to his productivity and performance the second he walked back into his office. He literally couldn't see the positives in his life and in his work. The opportunities, the possibilities, the chances for growth. And as a result, he didn't even have a fighting chance of capitalizing upon them. This is no small thing. Constantly scanning the world for the negative comes with a great cost. It undercuts our creativity, raises our stress levels, and lowers our motivation and our ability to accomplish goals. Bringing the Tetris effect home. Over the past year, as I've been working with the global tax accounting firm KPMG to help their tax auditors and managers become happier, I began to realize that many of the employees were suffering from an unfortunate problem. Many of them had to spend 8 to 14 hours a day scanning tax forms for errors. And as they did, their brains were becoming wired to look for mistakes. This made them very good at their jobs. But they were getting so expert at seeing errors and potential pitfalls that this habit started to spill over into other areas of their lives. Like the Tetris players who suddenly saw those blocks everywhere, these accountants experienced each day as a tax audit, always scanning the world for the worst. And as you can imagine, this was no picnic. And what's more, it was undermining their relationships at work and at home. In performance reviews, they noticed only the faults of their team members, never the strengths. When they went home to their families, they noticed only the C's on the kids' report cards, never the A's. When they ate at restaurants, they could only notice that the potatoes were underdone, never that the steak was cooked perfectly. One tax auditor confided that he had been very depressed over the past quarter. As we discussed why, he mentioned in passing that one day during a break at work, he had made an Excel spreadsheet listing all the mistakes his wife had made over the past 6 weeks. Imagine the reaction of his wife, or soon-to-be ex-wife, when he brought that list of faults home in an attempt to make things better. Tax auditors are far from the only ones who get stuck in this kind of pattern. Lawyers are just as susceptible, if not more so, which is one reason studies have found that they are 3.6 times more likely to suffer from major depressive disorder than the rest of the employed population. When I mentioned that statistic at a hospital in California, the doctors, not big fans of malpractice suits, burst into applause. This might seem a relatively surprising finding, given that lawyers have high levels of education, pay, and status. But in fact, given what they are required to do all day long, it's not that surprising at all. The problem starts in law school, where levels of distress spike as soon as the students settle into their classes and start learning the techniques of critical analysis. Why? Because as one study from the Yale Journal of Health Policy, Law, and Ethics explains, law schools teach students to look for flaws in arguments, and they train them to be critical rather than accepting. And while this is, of course, a crucial skill for lawyers in practice, when it starts to leak beyond the courtroom into their personal lives, it can have significant negative consequences. Trained to be on the lookout for the flaws in every argument, the holes in every case, they start to overestimate the significance and permanence of the problems they encounter, the fastest route to depression and anxiety, which in turn interferes with their ability to do their job. Over the years, I've talked with many lawyers who sheepishly admit that they had a habit of deposing their children when they got home from work. But if you were, as your alibi suggests, at the movies until 10:30, please explain to the court how you came to be 15 minutes late for curfew. Others have said they find themselves involuntarily thinking about quality time with their spouses in terms of quantified, billable hours. Even during their moments of leisure, the lawyers could tell you exactly how much money they had just wasted discussing the color of the new wallpaper. Like the fault-finding accountants, their brains get stuck in a pattern. And so it goes, in any profession or line of work. No one is immune. Athletes can't stop competing with their friends and families. Social workers who deal with domestic abuse can't stop distrusting men. Financial traders can't stop assessing the risk inherent in everything they do. Managers can't stop micromanaging their children's lives. Admittedly, being stuck in these patterns might well make someone very successful in a particular aspect of his or her work. Tax auditors should look for errors. Athletes should be competitive. Traders should apply rigorous risk analysis. The problem comes when individuals cannot compartmentalize their abilities. And when that happens, not only do they miss out on the happiness advantage, but their pessimistic, fault-finding mindset makes them far more susceptible to depression, stress, poor physical health, and even substance abuse. This is the essence of a negative Tetris effect, a cognitive pattern that decreases our overall success rates. But the Tetris effect need not be maladaptive. Just as our brains can be wired in ways that hold us back, we can retrain them to scan for the good things in life, to help us see more possibility, to feel more energy, and to succeed at higher levels. The first step is understanding just how much of what we see is solely a matter of focus. As William James once said, "My experience is what I agree to attend to." Your brain as a spam filter. On a daily basis, we're bombarded with competing demands on our attention. Think about all the things our brains have to attend to, even when we're engaged in a relatively passive activity, like sitting at Starbucks. We cannot possibly listen to the music, enjoy the taste of the coffee, eavesdrop on the conversation at the next table, and note the outfits of the people milling about, all while thinking about what we have to do at work later that day, what we're going to cook for dinner, and how we're going to pay for that big renovation we're doing on the house. To deal with this overload, our brains have a filter that only lets the most pertinent information through to our consciousness. This filter is much like the spam blocker on your email. Your spam blocker follows certain rules that tell it to delete noxious and unimportant emails without you even having to see or process them. The same thing goes on in our brains. Scientists estimate that we can remember only one of every 100 pieces of information we receive. The rest, effectively, gets filtered out, dumped into the brain's spam file. Now, all of this might work fine if only we could trust our neural spam filter to know exactly what is best for us. Unfortunately, we can't. Spam filters, whether in our heads or our email, scan only for what they are programmed to find. If we have programmed our brain's filter to delete the positive, that data will cease to exist for us, as surely as the chain letters and advertisements cease to exist in our inbox. As you're about to learn, we see what we look for, and we miss the rest. Gorillas and Priuses. In one of psychology's best-known experiments, volunteers watch a video of two basketball teams, one wearing white shirts, the other black ones, who are passing around a basketball. As they watch, the viewers have to count the number of times the white team passes the ball. About 25 seconds into the video, a person in a full-body gorilla costume walks straight through the action, traveling from right to left across the screen for a full 5 seconds, as the team members continue to pass the ball. Afterward, the viewers are asked to write down the number of passes they counted, and then answer a series of additional questions that go something like this. Did you notice anything unusual about the video? Did you see anyone in the video besides the six basketball players? Did you, notice a giant gorilla? Unbelievably, when psychologists tried this out on more than 200 people, back in the days before it became a viral YouTube video everyone has seen, nearly half of them, 46%, completely missed the gorilla. After the experiment, when the researchers told them about the gorilla, many of them refused to believe that they had missed something so obvious and demanded to view the video again. On the second viewing, now that they were looking for the gorilla, it was, of course, impossible to miss. So why did so many of them fail to see it the first time? Because they were so focused on counting passes, their neural filters had simply dumped the gorilla sighting right into their spam folder. This experiment highlights what psychologists call inattentional blindness, our frequent inability to see what is often right in front of us if we're not focusing directly on it. This aspect of human biology means that we can miss an astoundingly large number of things we might consider obvious. For instance, studies show that when people look away from a researcher for 30 seconds and then turn their attention back, many won't notice that the researcher is suddenly wearing a different color shirt. Other experiments have found that when pedestrians are stopped on the street and asked a question, a large number won't even notice if the person asking the question has quickly swapped places with somebody else, so that they are now talking to a different person entirely. In essence, we tend to miss what we're not looking for. This selective perception is also why, when we are looking for something, we see it everywhere. You've probably experienced this a million times. You hear a song once, and suddenly, it seems it's always on the radio. You buy a new style of sneaker, and soon everyone at the gym is wearing the exact same pair. I remember the day I decided to buy a Toyota Prius. The streets suddenly began to overflow with them. Every fourth car seemed to be a blue Prius, exactly the color I wanted to buy. Had the people in my town just that day decided to all go out and buy blue Priuses? Had the advertisers found out I was wavering and strategically inundated my environment with their product to seal my decision? Of course not. Nothing had changed but my focus. Try this little experiment. Close your eyes and think of the color red. Really picture it in your mind's eye. Now open your eyes and look around your room. Is red popping out at you everywhere? Assuming elves didn't repaint your furniture while your eyes were closed, your heightened perception is due only to your change in focus. Repeated studies have shown that two people can view the same situation and actually see different things, depending on what they're expecting to see. It's not just that they want to come away with different interpretations of the same event, but that they actually have seen different things in their visual field. For example, one study found that two people can look at the same picture of a friend and see two completely different expressions on that friend's face. This not only affects our social relationships, if we are programmed to always read people negatively, it can hurt us at work as well. Think of the consequences of reading a potential customer's expression as disinterest, when really it's satisfaction, or reading a colleague's attitude as arrogance, when really it's helpfulness. This is essentially what was going on with the two employees I overheard outside in Australia. Both aspects of the weather were there for them to experience in equal parts. The sunshine and the heat. The first man found the sunshine impossible to miss. The second man wasn't trying to be a curmudgeon. The unbearable heat was simply the only thing he could see. While there are always different ways to see something, not all ways of seeing are created equal. As we know from people stuck in a negative Tetris effect, the consequences can be debilitating to both our happiness and our work performance. On the other hand, imagine a way of seeing that constantly picks up on the positives in every situation. That's the goal of a positive Tetris effect. Instead of creating a cognitive pattern that looks for negatives and blocks success, it trains our brains to scan the world for the opportunities and ideas that allow our success rate to grow. The power of a positive Tetris effect. When our brains constantly scan for and focus on the positive, we profit from three of the most important tools available to us: happiness, gratitude, and optimism. The role happiness plays should be obvious. The more you pick up on the positive around you, the better you'll feel. and we've already seen the advantages to performance that brings. The second mechanism at work here is gratitude, because the more opportunities for positivity we see, the more grateful we become. Psychologist Robert Emmons, who has spent nearly his entire career studying gratitude, has found that few things in life are as integral to our well-being. Countless other studies have shown that consistently grateful people are more energetic, emotionally intelligent, forgiving, and less likely to be depressed, anxious, or lonely. And it's not that people are only grateful because they are happier either. Gratitude is proven to be a significant cause of positive outcomes. When researchers pick random volunteers and train them to be more grateful over a period of a few weeks, they become happier and more optimistic, feel more socially connected, enjoy better quality sleep, and even experience fewer headaches than control groups. The third driver of the positive Tetris effect is optimism. This instinctively makes sense. The more your brain picks up on the positive, the more you'll expect this trend to continue, and so the more optimistic you'll be. And optimism, it turns out, is a tremendously powerful predictor of work performance. Studies have shown that optimists set more goals and more difficult goals than pessimists, and put more effort into attaining those goals, staying more engaged in the face of difficulty, and rise above obstacles more easily. Optimists also cope better in high-stress situations and are better able to maintain high levels of well-being during times of hardship, all skills that are crucial to high performance in a demanding work environment. As we saw briefly in the last chapter, expecting positive outcomes actually makes them more likely to arise. Few people have proven this more cleverly than researcher Richard Weissman, who set out to discover why some of us seem to be consistently lucky, while others can't buy a break. As you might have guessed, it turns out that there is no such thing, in a scientific sense at least, as luck. The only difference, and it's a big one, is whether or not people think that they are lucky. In essence, whether they expect good or bad things to happen to them. Weissman asked volunteers to read through a newspaper and count how many photographs were in it. The people who claimed to be lucky took merely seconds to accomplish this task, while the unlucky ones took an average of 2 minutes. Why? Well, on the second page of the newspaper, a very large message read, "Stop counting. There are 43 photos in this newspaper." The answer, in short, was plain as day, but the unlucky people were far more likely to miss it, while the lucky people tended to see it. As an added bonus, halfway through the newspaper was another message that read, "Stop counting. Tell the experimenter you have seen this and win $250. The people who claimed to be unlucky in life again looked right past this opportunity. Stuck in a negative Tetris effect, they were incapable of seeing what was so clear to others, and their performance and wallets suffered because of it. The extraordinary thing about Weissman's study is that the same possibility for huge reward was latent in everyone's environment. It was just a matter of whether or not they picked up on it. Think of the consequences this has on your career success, which is almost entirely predicated on your ability to spot and then capitalize on opportunities. In fact, 69% of high school and college students report that their career decisions depended on chance encounters. The difference between people who capitalize on these chances and those who watch them pass by or miss them entirely is all a matter of focus. When someone is stuck in a negative Tetris effect, his brain is quite literally incapable of seeing these opportunities. But armed with positivity, the brain stays open to possibility. Psychologists call this predictive encoding. Priming yourself to expect a favorable outcome actually encodes your brain to recognize the outcome when it does in fact arise. An executive I worked with once told me about a theater in his hometown. Costumes were proving a big financial drain for the theater, since they were worn only once and were useless thereafter. Instead of lamenting this as a fixed cost of doing business, the owners reframed the situation and looked for possibility. First, they started renting out the costumes, creating a profitable side business. Then they donated money from the rentals to a local nonprofit organization that combats child abuse. Because they had stayed optimistic, they were able to both make brilliant use of the costumes and also grow a double bottom line. They helped the community prosper while also increasing revenue for their theater. Imagine a typical paper-pushing office. The objective reality of the physical place will always be the same. Walls, carpet, stapler, computer. But as with everything else, how we see that space is up to us. Some people will view the environment as constricting, confining, and depressing. Others will see it as energizing and empowering. In other words, to some, it's an office. To others, it's a prison cell, though hopefully you don't have bars on your office windows. Who do you think is more likely to thrive in these surroundings? Who will see more opportunities for growth and success? Who will spot the ad in the newspaper that offers a free $250? Or see how to turn an initial defeat into a profitable side business? Now that we know how powerful a positive Tetris effect can be, we need to know how exactly we can train our brains to let in these messages that make us more adaptive, more creative, and more motivated. Messages that allow us to spot and pounce on more opportunities at work and at play.
Getting stuck in a positive Tetris effect. Just as it takes days of concentrated practice to master a video game, training your brain to notice more opportunities takes practice focusing on the positive. The best way to kickstart this is to start making a daily list of the good things in your job, your career, and your life. It may sound hokey or ridiculously simple, and indeed the activity itself is simple. But over a decade of empirical studies has proven the profound effect it has on the way our brains are wired. When you write down a list of three good things that happened that day, your brain will be forced to scan the last 24 hours for potential positives. Things that brought small or large laughs, feelings of accomplishment at work, a strengthened connection with family, a glimmer of hope for the future. In just 5 minutes a day, this trains the brain to become more skilled at noticing and focusing on possibilities for personal and professional growth, and seizing opportunities to act on them. At the same time, because we can only focus on so much at once, our brains push out those small annoyances and frustrations that used to loom large into the background, even out of our visual field entirely. This exercise has staying power. One study found that participants who wrote down three good things each day for a week were happier and less depressed at the 1 month, 3 month, and 6 month follow-ups. More amazing, even after stopping the exercise, they remained significantly happier and showed higher levels of optimism. The better they got at scanning the world for good things to write down, the more good things they saw, without even trying, wherever they looked. The items you write down each day don't need to be profound or complicated, only specific. You can mention the delicious takeout Thai food you had for dinner, your child's bear hug at the end of a long day, or the well-deserved acknowledgement from your boss at work. A variation on the three good things exercise is to write a short journal entry about a positive experience. We've long known that venting about hardships and suffering can provide welcome relief, but researchers Chad Burton and Laura King have found that journaling about positive experiences has at least an equally powerful effect. In one experiment, they instructed people to write about a positive experience for 20 minutes, 3 times a week, and then compared them to a control group who wrote about neutral topics. Not only did the first group experience larger spikes in happiness, but 3 months later, they even had fewer symptoms of illness. Beyond all these benefits, you'll also notice that all the activities from the previous two chapters start coming to you more naturally. For instance, falling into a positive Tetris effect helps leaders give more frequent recognition and encouragement, which tips their teams above the Lasada line. It makes the meaning and purpose in your job more apparent, so that you can start connecting to your calling. It makes it easier to adopt an expressive and positive tone as you deliver task instructions, which primes your employees for enhanced creativity and problem solving. and it flat out makes you happier, which means your own brain will be functioning at a higher level for more of the time. Practice, practice, practice. Of course, we can build this Tetris effect only through consistency. As with any skill, the more we practice, the more easily and naturally it comes. Since the best way to ensure follow-through on a desired activity is to make it a habit, more about this in Principle 6, the key here is to ritualize the task. For example, pick the same time each day to write down your gratitude list, and keep the necessary items easily accessible and convenient. A small steno pad and pen sit on my bedside table specifically for this purpose. When I worked with employees at American Express, I encouraged them to set a Microsoft Outlook alert for 11 a.m. every day to remind themselves to write down their three good things. The bankers I worked with in Hong Kong preferred to write down their list every morning before they checked their email. The CEOs I trained in Africa opted to say three gratitudes at the dinner table with their children each night. It doesn't matter when you do it, as long as you do it on a regular basis. The more you involve others, the more the benefits multiply. When the CEOs in Africa brought the activity to their children, they not only discovered more things to be grateful about, but were also held more accountable for keeping up with the exercise. Several of the CEOs told me that whenever they'd had an especially terrible day at work and tried to skip writing down the three good things, their children actually refused to eat dinner until the exercise was completed. This kind of social support greatly increases the chances that these positive habits will stick. That's why I tell business leaders to do these exercises with their spouses as they fall asleep at night or over breakfast before they leave for work. A bonus, as they become more skilled at picking up on the positives all around them, they start to become better at seeing the things to be grateful for in their marriages as well. Furthermore, these exercises work as well with kindergartners as with college students, and as well with middle managers or small business owners as they do with the captains of industry and Wall Street analysts. It's not your age or what you do for a living. It's the training and consistency that count. Rose-tinted glasses. Here's a common question I get when I discuss the virtues of a positive Tetris effect. If I focus only on the good, won't I be blind to real problems? You can't run a business wearing rose-colored glasses. In a sense, this is true. Looking at the world through a lens that completely filters out all negatives comes with its own problems. That's why I like to offer a slightly revised version of the metaphor, rose-tinted glasses. As the name implies, rose-tinted glasses let the really major problems into our field of vision, while still keeping our focus largely on the positive. So to this executive, I would say, not only can you run a business wearing rose-tinted glasses, but you should. Science has shown that seeking out the positive has too many tangible advantages to be dismissed as mere cockeyed optimism or wishful thinking. Still, to his question, can positivity be overdone? Absolutely. As has become all too evident in recent years, irrational optimism is the reason market bubbles form and inevitably burst. It causes us to buy houses we can't afford and to live above our means. It causes business leaders to sugarcoat the present and end up unprepared for the future. It can blind us to problems that need fixing or areas that need improving. Studies on positive illusions conclude that optimism becomes maladaptive when it causes us to grossly overestimate our current abilities. There are also times when pessimism comes in handy, like when it stops us from making that foolish investment or risky career move, or from gambling with our health. Being critical can also be useful not just to individuals and businesses, but to society as a whole, especially when it drives us to acknowledge inequalities and work to right them. The key, then, is not to completely shut out all the bad, all the time, but to have a reasonable, realistic, healthy sense of optimism. The ideal mindset
isn't heedless of risk, but it does give priority to the good, not just because that makes us happier, but because that is precisely what creates more good. Given the choice between seeing the world through rose-tinted glasses, we're always walking around under a rain cloud. The contest isn't even close. In business and in life, the reasonable optimist will win every time. When we train our brains to adapt a positive Tetris effect, we're not just improving our chances at happiness, we're setting off a chain of events that helps us to reap all the benefits of a positive brain. Focusing on the good isn't just about overcoming our inner grump to see the glass half full. It's about opening our minds to the ideas and opportunities that will help us to be more productive, effective, and successful at work and in life. The possibilities, like the free $250, are there for everyone to see. Will you look right past them, or will you train your brain to see more? Principle number 4, falling up. Capitalizing on the downs to build upward momentum. As an undergraduate, I was often encouraged to sell my body. The psychology department was constantly offering money for willing research subjects, and since I was almost always short of funds, I was always a willing guinea pig for experiments that range from mere humiliation to full-on trickery. Everything from uncomfortable social encounters to repeated MRIs to grueling trials of mental and physical abilities. But the most memorable experiment of them all was a seemingly benign one called Helping the Elderly. The study was 3 hours long and promised to pay $20. To get things underway, two research assistants handed me a set of bike reflectors with Velcro straps and a pair of tight white biker shorts. One of the assistants said formally, "Please attach these reflectors to each of the joints on your body and put on the shorts. And oh yes, we just ran out of the white t-shirts, so you'll have to go topless. Do you wish to proceed?" For $20, they clearly underestimated me. A few minutes later, clad in reflective sensors covering my elbows, wrists, and knees, I emerged looking like a bare-chested robot. They then explained the study. The researchers were examining how the elderly fall to the ground so that they could eventually help senior citizens avoid injuries. Of course, they couldn't actually ask the elderly to fall repeatedly for the study, so they recruited college students instead. Made perfect sense to me. I was told to walk down a padded hallway in the dark while a video camera recorded the position of the reflectors on my joints. As I walked, one of four things would happen. Number one, the floor would suddenly slide to the left, and I would crash onto the lightly padded walkway. Number two, the floor would suddenly slide to the right, throwing off my balance and sending me crashing down to the left. Number three, a cord attached to my right leg would be yanked out behind me, pitching me face first onto the walkway. And four, if none of these things happened to me by the time I got to the end of the walkway, I was just supposed to throw myself to the ground. That last one sounded especially ludicrous. What kind of elderly person intentionally throws himself on the floor? But $20 was on the line, and so for the next hour, I fell down once about every 30 seconds. At 120 falls, the research assistants emerged, giggled sheepishly, and admitted they had forgotten to put the video in the recorder. They would need to retape all the falls again. "Do you want to proceed?" Again, I said yes. Another 120 falls later, I was bruised, battered, and exhausted. With all the gear I had on, merely picking myself up off the mats took an enormous amount of energy, and the whole ordeal had taken a painful toll on my body. When I finally stumbled out into the hallway, the research assistants had been joined by a distinguished-looking professor, summoned to investigate a major irregularity. The experiment had never lasted this long. The study, it turned out, had nothing to do with helping the elderly. Note to self, never trust the name of a psychology department study. These researchers were actually studying motivation and resilience. They wanted to know how much pain and discomfort could you put people through before they gave up? How much would a person withstand to get a reward he had set out to get? In my case, the answer was a lot. The professor had come down to the hospital on a Saturday because I was the only one who had ever lasted the full 3 hours. As they stood there explaining all this to me, I couldn't help but wonder if I was supposed to feel stupid for withstanding all that abuse for a measly $20. But before I could say anything, the professor handed me 10 crisp $20 bills. "It's the least we can do for putting you through all that," he said. "The more subjects pick themselves up off the mats and keep going, the larger their reward. You've won the grand prize, $200. That was nice of him, but more memorable than the generous prize were the lessons I learned about the nature of resilience, about picking ourselves up when we fall. Fast forward a decade later, and I was reenacting a form of helping the elderly with tens of thousands of business leaders across the globe. In the midst of the greatest down economy of our time, executives felt the floor had dropped out from underneath them. Investors felt like their foundation had violently shifted, and employees, at all levels, had found their legs yanked out by forces beyond their control. Every continent I traveled to, the refrain was the same. When I'm so exhausted from falling over and over again, how will I find the energy to pick myself up? Back in my undergraduate guinea pig days, I wouldn't have had a good answer for them. But this time, I did. A strategy I first observed back in 2006, studying the most resilient of those Harvard students. Falling up. Mapping the way to success. The human brain is constantly creating and revising mental maps to help us navigate our way through this complex and ever-changing world, kind of like a tireless, overeager cartographer. This tendency has been wired in us through thousands of years of evolution. In order to survive, we must create physical maps of our environment, map out strategies for getting food and sex, and map out the possible effects of our actions. But these maps aren't just crucial to survival in the wilderness. They are vital to succeeding and thriving in the business world. If you are talking to a client, for example, and trying to decide whether to lowball or highball an offer, your brain is unconsciously, and sometimes consciously, creating an event map with two possible paths, and then trying to predict where those paths will lead. If you lowball, you might predict this path will lead to the client making a counteroffer, which will eventually take you to the final destination of an accepted bid. If you highball it, on the other hand, the path may lead to the client getting offended and ultimately taking his business elsewhere. All human decisions involve this kind of mental mapping. They start with an "I am here" point, the status quo, from which a variety of paths radiate outward, the number depending on the complexity of the decision and the clarity of your thinking at that moment. The most successful decisions come when we are thinking clearly and creatively enough to recognize all the paths available to us and accurately predict where that path will lead. The problem is that when we are stressed or in a crisis, many people miss the most important path of all. The path up. On every mental map, after crisis or adversity, there are three mental paths. One that keeps circling around where you currently are. That is, the negative event creates no change. You end where you start. Another mental path leads you toward further negative consequences. That is, you are far worse off after the negative event. This path is why we are afraid of conflict and challenge. And one, which I call the third path, that leads us from failure or setback to a place where we are even stronger and more capable than before the fall. To be sure, finding that path in challenging times isn't easy. In a crisis, economic or otherwise, we tend to form incomplete mental maps. And ironically, the path we have trouble seeing is often the most positive, productive one. In fact, when we feel helpless and hopeless, we stop believing such a path even exists. So we don't even bother to look for it. But this is the very path we should be looking for, because, as we'll see, our ability to find the third path is the difference between those who are crippled by failure and those who rise above it. Study after study shows that if we are able to conceive of failure as an opportunity for growth, we are all the more likely to experience that growth. Conversely, if we conceive of a fall as the worst thing in the world, it becomes just that. Jim Collins, author of Good to Great, reminds us that we are not imprisoned by our circumstances, our setbacks, our history, our mistakes, or even staggering defeats along the way. We are freed by our choices. By scanning our mental map for positive opportunities and by rejecting the belief that every down in life leads us only further downward, we give ourselves the greatest power possible. The ability to move up, not despite the setbacks, but because of them. In this chapter, you'll learn how. Post-traumatic growth. In today's society, it's all too easy to overlook the third path. One particularly salient example of this is the fact that when soldiers are headed to combat, psychologists commonly tell them that they will return either normal or with post-traumatic stress disorder. What this does, in effect, is give these soldiers a mental map with only two paths, normalcy and psychic distress. Yet while PTSD is of course a well-documented and serious consequence of war, and while war can be so horrifying, that returning normal might be a very attractive promise. Another large body of research proves the existence of a third, far better path. Post-traumatic growth. Bereavement, bone marrow transplantation, breast cancer, chronic illness, heart attack, military combat, natural disaster, physical assault, refugee displacement. If this reads like a random clip from an alphabetized nightmare list of the very worst things that can befall us, that's because it basically is. But it also happens to be a list of events that researchers have found to spur profound positive growth in many, many individuals. Psychologists have termed this experience adversarial growth or post-traumatic growth to distinguish it from the better known term post-traumatic stress. When I encountered this newer body of research for the first time, I was actually quite upset. Why had I not heard of it before? I felt like the world had been censoring research that was not only surprising, but could improve thousands of lives. And we're not just talking about a few fringe studies, but many distinguished ones. Over the last two decades, psychologists Richard Tedeschi and his colleagues have made the empirical study of post-traumatic growth their mission. While Tedeschi admits that the idea itself is ancient, surely you've heard the maxim, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. He explains it has only been in the last 25 years or so that this phenomenon, the possibility of something good emerging from the struggle with something very difficult, has been the study of systematic theorizing and empirical investigation. Thanks to this study, today we can say for certain, not just anecdotally, that great suffering or trauma can actually lead to great positive change across a wide range of experiences. After the March 11, 2004 train bombings in Madrid, for example, psychologists found many residents experienced positive psychological growth. So too do the majority of women diagnosed with breast cancer. What kind of positive growth? Increases in spirituality, compassion for others, openness, and even, eventually, overall life satisfaction. After trauma, people also report enhanced personal strength and self-confidence, as well as a heightened appreciation for and a greater intimacy in their social relationships. Of course, this isn't true for everybody. So what distinguishes the people who find growth in these experiences from those who don't? There are a number of mechanisms involved, but not surprisingly, mindset takes center stage. People's ability to find the path up rests largely on how they conceive of the cards they have been dealt. So the strategies that most often lead to adversarial growth include positive reinterpretation of the situation or event, optimism, acceptance, and coping mechanisms that include focusing on the problem head on, rather than trying to avoid it or deny it. As one set of researchers explains, it appears that it is not the type of event per se that influences post-traumatic growth, but rather the subjective experience of the event. In other words, the people who can most successfully get themselves off the mat are those who define themselves not by what has happened to them, but by what they can make out of what has happened. These are the people who actually use adversity to find the path forward. They speak not just of bouncing back, but of bouncing forward. Eureka! We failed. While many of us, thankfully, live lives free of serious trauma, we all experience adversity of one kind or another at some point in our lives. Mistakes, obstacles, failure, disappointment, suffering. We have many words to describe the degrees of hardship that could befall us at any given moment in our personal or professional lives. And yet, with every setback, comes some opportunity for growth that we can teach ourselves to see and take advantage of. As my mentor Tal Ben-Shahar likes to say, it's not that everything happens for the best, but instead that we can make the best of everything that happens. The most successful people see adversity not as a stumbling block, but as a stepping stone to greatness. Indeed, early failure is often the fuel for the very ideas that eventually transform industries, make record profits, and reinvent careers. We've all heard the usual examples. Michael Jordan cut from his high school basketball team. Walt Disney fired by a newspaper editor for not being creative enough. The Beatles turned away by a record executive who told them that guitar groups are on their way out. In fact, many of their winning mantras essentially describe the notion of falling up. "I've failed over and over again in my life," Jordan once said, "and that is why I succeed." Robert F. Kennedy said much the same. "Only those who dare to fail greatly can ever achieve greatly." And Thomas Edison, too, once claimed that he had failed his way to success. For this very reason, many venture capitalists will only hire managers who have already experienced their share of business flops. A spotless resume is not nearly as promising as one that showcases defeat and growth. So instead of putting a wall around failure as if it's radioactive, one consultant explains, companies should be having failure parties. Coca-Cola lives this creed to great effect. In 2009, Coke's CEO actually started his annual investors meeting not by trumpeting the company's many successes, but by listing all of their failures. Ever heard of OK Soda, Surge, or Choglet? Probably not. The point of highlighting all of these failures was to let the investors know that mistakes would sometimes be made and money would sometimes be lost, but that from these failures come valuable lessons, all of which have contributed to Coca-Cola's continuing triumphs. Harvard Business Review points out that the smartest companies even commit errors on purpose, just to spur the kind of creative problem solving that leads to the most innovative ideas and solutions. For example, back during Bell Telephone's heyday, the company usually required deposits from its high-risk customers. But it once purposely let 100,000 of these customers slide to see who would pay their bills on time regardless and who would not. With this information, the company was able to design a far more efficient screening process, one that ended up adding millions of dollars of revenue. As the Harvard Business authors conclude, making mistakes like this is a powerful way to accelerate learning and increase competitiveness. It's for this reason that, however counterintuitive it may seem, psychologists actually recommend that we fail early and often. In his book, The Pursuit of Perfect, Tal Ben-Shahar writes that we can only learn to deal with failure by actually experiencing failure, by living through it. The earlier we face difficulties and drawbacks, the better prepared we are to deal with the inevitable obstacles along our path. Studies have borne this out. In one experiment, where 90 people went through a software training program, half were taught to prevent errors from occurring, while the other half were guided into mistakes during training. And lo and behold, the group encouraged to make errors not only exhibited greater feelings of self-efficacy, but because they had learned to figure their own way out of mistakes, they were also far faster and more accurate in how they used the software later on. How the third path gets hidden. Unfortunately, the path from failure to success is not always easy to spot. In the midst of a crisis, we can get so stuck in the misery of the status quo that we forget another path is available. I saw this firsthand as the 2008 financial crisis swiftly and viciously pulled the floor out from under an entire workforce. One day in particular sticks out in my mind. I was in a Manhattan skyscraper overlooking the void left 7 years earlier by the September 11th attacks. That chilling memory was perhaps reason enough to feel qualms about speaking about the psychology of happiness to a group of senior vice presidents at a global credit card company. As I walked into the room and was hit by palpable despondency, these qualms only multiplied. Instead of the confident smiles and direct eye contact every speaker hopes to receive from an audience, I was met with ashen faces and utter silence. There was still about a half an hour until my talk, and employees were on a break from their morning meeting. Usually during breaks like this, everyone is typing furiously on a BlackBerry while simultaneously gulping coffee and chatting with at least four people. But not this time. The head of HR quickly pulled me aside and started speaking in anxious, hushed tones. He told me that the group had just moments before been informed of the company's planned response to the economic collapse, which included vast restructuring, drastic changes to job responsibilities, and massive layoffs. These people still had their jobs, he told me, but many would be losing valuable team members and colleagues, and nobody's career would be the same as it had been at daybreak. Before I could fully process the shifting of the ground, I realized a microphone was being attached to my shirt. Rarely have I dreaded talking about happiness, but this was one such moment. Over the next few weeks and months, I paced the hallways of Fortune 500 firms in Hong Kong, Tokyo, Singapore, Sydney, London, and New York, waiting to speak hard on the heels of announcements that bonuses were being deep-sixed and workforces cut practically in half. At each company, I found more than a few managers and employees who were so completely frozen with fear, they were unable to take any kind of action. Their mental maps seemed stuck on the grim present, or worse, focused on paths that led further downward, to places like unemployment or bankruptcy. One unhappy manager at a small manufacturing company in Seattle told me that while her team used to be famous for its lively meetings, she now found herself staring into zombie eyes and mute mouths. Another executive from a construction company in Johannesburg lamented that his usually extroverted sales force was avoiding client calls, not wanting to deliver more bad news. They couldn't see a positive future for these clients or for themselves, so why bother? At the headquarters of one global financial firm, I walked onto the catwalk above the expansive trading floor, famous for being the size of four football fields stacked back to back. Usually packed to the gills and vibrating with energy and activity, the giant room this time was wrapped in an ominous hush. People were walking around the empty desks with heads down, avoiding eye contact, and as it seemed to me, avoiding work altogether. Right when extra effort was most needed, the people I kept meeting seemed paralyzed, like they had given up.
What was going on? Learning helplessness. To understand the psychology of failure and success in the modern business world, we need to step back briefly to the tail end of the age of Aquarius. In the 1960s, Martin Seligman was not yet the founding father of positive psychology. He was only a lowly graduate student, studying the opposite of happiness in his university's laboratory. Older researchers in Seligman's lab were doing some experiments with dogs, pairing noises, like a bell, with small electric shocks to see how the dogs would eventually react to the bell alone. Then, after this conditioning was complete, the researchers would put each dog in a shuttle box, a large box with two compartments, separated by a low wall. In one compartment, the dogs would get shocked, but on the other side, they would be safe from shocks, and it was easy to jump over the wall. The researchers predicted that once the dogs heard the bell, they would immediately jump into the safe half of the box, so they could avoid the shock they knew would follow. But that's not at all what happened. As Seligman now tells the story, he remembers walking into the lab one day and overhearing the older researchers complaining. "It's the dogs," they lamented. "The dogs won't do anything. Something's wrong with them." Before the experiment started, the dogs had been able to jump over the barriers just fine. But this time, they were just lying there. While the researchers contemplated what seemed to be a failed experiment, Seligman realized the value of what they had just stumbled upon. They had accidentally taught the dogs to be helpless. Earlier, the dogs had learned that once the bell rang, a shock was sure to follow, no matter what. So now, in this new situation, they didn't try jumping to the safe half of the box because they believed there was nothing that they could do to avoid the shock. Just like the workers at the Johannesburg Construction Company, they essentially figured, why bother? After decades of studying human behavior, Seligman and his colleagues found that the same patterns of helplessness that he saw in those dogs are incredibly common in humans. When we fail, or when life delivers us a shock, we can become so hopeless that we respond by simply giving up. The fact is that in our modern, often overstressed business world, cubicles are the new shuttle boxes, and workers the new dogs. In fact, one study shows just how closely we humans resemble our canine counterparts. Researchers took two groups of people into a room, turned on a loud noise, and then told them to figure out how to turn it off by pressing buttons on a panel. The first group tried every combination of buttons, but nothing worked to stop the noise. Another example of devious psychologists at work. The second group, acting as a control, was given a panel of buttons that did successfully turn off the noise. Then both groups were given the same second task. They were put into a new room, the equivalent of a shuttle box, and were once again treated to an obnoxious noise. This time, both groups could easily stop the noise by simply moving a hand from one side to the other, just like the dogs could easily move to the other side of the box. The control group quickly figured this out and stopped the blare. But the group that had first been exposed to a noise they couldn't stop now just let their hands lay there, not even bothering to move them or try to make the noise stop. As one of the researchers said, it was as if they had learned they were helpless to turn off noise, so they didn't even try, even though everything else, the time and place, all that, had changed. They carried that noise helplessness right through to a new experiment. Economic whiplash. Shanghai is a city you can appreciate just for the sheer boomtown wonder of it all. As recently as the mid-1990s, much of the city, now home to 19 million people, was still farmland. But as foreign investment flowed into China and development took off, 20-story office buildings, once the city's highest, suddenly found themselves dwarfed by the 100-story behemoths that crowded the skyline, seeming to promise a prosperity that had no end in sight. By the time I made my first trip to Shanghai, in the summer of 2008, That promise had been put on hold, not just in China, but around the globe. Everywhere I went, from the 104th floor of the office building in the city's Pudong financial district,